This is the place, and this is the time. Here and now, the mystery awaits to break into our experience, to change our minds, to change our lives, to change our ways, to help us see the world and the whole of life in a new light. This is the place. This is the time. Here and now, let us praise the mystery by joining together in song. At the center of our service and at the center of our lives, we take this time to light candles of memory, candles of hope, or because we feel troubled, blessed, conflicted, or simply because we'd like to add a little light to the world. Now, in an attitude of prayer. Mystery of many names, and mystery beyond all naming. This morning we speak from within ourselves in hopes of seeing the road ahead. We don't ask for a glimpse of a future. We simply wish to see without clouded vision that which lies before us. We all come to this enterprise with our own set of blinders on. It's time to see without the blinders. Time to feel without worrying about hurting. Time to process simply what comes our way. We are held back by our inability to imagine ourselves different. Yet, as anyone will attest, simply gazing at old photographs has the ability to shame us into laughter, envy, remorse. Let us see now that we are perfect in the manner in which we address the world today, right now, this very instant. Yes, the past was different. Yes, the future will be something unexpected. But from deep within each of us, let us sigh and give up any notion that we can control any of this nonsense. As mentioned in the responsive reading today, help us through the strength that we gather from one another to be able to say with the poet, forward, after the great companions, and to belong to them. They too are on the road onward to that which is endless as it was beginningless, to undergo much, tramps of days and rests of nights, to see nothing anywhere but what we may reach it and pass it, to look up and down no road but it stretches and waits for us, to know the universe itself as a road, as many roads, as roads for traveling souls. We pray this in the name of everything that is holy. And that is precisely everything. For who sees anything different in you? What do you have that you have not received? And if you have received it, why do you boast as if it were not a gift? I'm going to tell you a story now that I put in the newsletter, and if you read it in the newsletter, I'm not going to apologize for telling it again, because as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe that repetition strengthens and confirms. When my daughter was 6 months old, I really wanted to be a hero in her life, and her mother was breastfeeding her, and I couldn't do that. I wanted to, but I couldn't. So I went out to a toy store, and I bought her a jack-in-the-box gift. I knew she was going to love it. When I got home, there she was on the floor, crawling around. I got down on the floor with her, and, you know, she liked the colors, and she pounded on the tin box, and she liked it when she licked it, and she liked it when she tried to eat it. So I started turning the crank. You know, it played that little song, "All Around the Mulberry Bush, the Monkey Chase." She loved that. That big toothless grin, and her hands were clapping. And then the moment of truth. Pop goes the weasel. When that clown jumped out of there, I'm telling you, her cries of laughter changed to wails And I'm not referring to that place close to England. She lost it, and I didn't know what to do, so I put the clown back in there, and I closed the top, and I cranked it real fast again and had it pop out again. Boy, that was dumb. She threw herself on the floor and really let go that time. Her mother had to come in and rescue her. And there I was on the floor with that jack-in-the-box gift. Excuse me for sounding like Forrest Gump, but life is like a jack-in-the-box gift. It is. Well, we get things and we think one thing is going to happen, and all of a sudden something happens that terrifies us or scares us or changes things. That's why I'm telling you about this. The good news is, 6 months later, on her first birthday, it was her favorite gift. We at First Church recently finished our canvassing campaign. Members Keith Savage and Sean Parham ran a great campaign. Looks like pledges are up, way up. Now, that's not an excuse if you haven't pledged yet to not pledge. Because believe it or not, we're counting on those who haven't pledged yet also. Anyway, it's appropriate after thinking about giving that we talk about receiving. Hurricane Katrina offered everyone in the state and all over the country lots of opportunities for giving. The response from the people was tremendous, even if the response from the government was less than auspicious. Let's face it. Giving opens us up. Our hearts widen dramatically, and we become the one that P.T. Barnum says is born every moment. When our hearts are open, we gladly play the fool. Why do you think it feels so good to fall in love and find somebody who wants your gifts? You don't care if you look like an idiot when you're giving. It's from the heart. I like that Dr. Pepper commercial where the guy does all these things for this woman, and finally, she tries to take his drink from him. Or maybe she's just trying to make it look like it's not part of his anatomy. Anyway, he gets up and runs out of the house. Now, you can raise that commercial up a notch and make that Dr. Pepper a beer. But no beer commercial is going to go there. The message is clear. Don't get between a drinker and his drink. Anyway, the first time I saw that ad, I thought, now there's a relationship that's going to last. You have to draw the line somewhere, right? You've got to have some boundaries. My father told me that relationships were 60-40. Sometimes you're 60, sometimes you're 40. He didn't bother to tell me if you're a guy, you're 40 lots of the time, but Jesus said it's more blessed to give than to receive. But does anybody really believe that nowadays? We all know that life is a lot of give and take, but I think taking, receiving, has been tainted. And I don't think it's because we'd rather give than receive. I think it's because we want people to think that everything we are, everything we stand for, everything that we fought so hard for, all these things, we'd like it if people thought those things were somehow self-generated, that we did it the old-fashioned way, we did it ourselves. In his letter to the church in Corinth, Paul says, who sees anything different in you? What do you have that you haven't received? And if you have received it, why do you boast as if it were not a gift? There's a better translation of that in Eugene Peterson's New Testament called The Message. And here's the way that reads. For who do you know who really knows you, knows your heart? And even if they did, is there anything you would discover in you, that they would discover in you, that you could actually take credit for? Isn't everything you have and everything you are sheer gifts from God? When First Church member Amy Parham delivered her baby daughter, she said in the Austin Magazine ParentWise that she knew on some level that that child was going to have Down syndrome. Yet, as the article attests, their so-called burden has blossomed and continues to blossom in their lives because their daughter, Ava Grace, will never stop giving. When I was the wagon master at Old City Park, Dallas, Texas, my job was to take care of two 1,100-pound mammoth stock jackasses. That's their true name, jackasses. I was to hook them up every day and drive them around the park, and kids rode in them. And one day a bus arrived with a bunch of kids with Down syndrome. And when I was unhitching the wagon after I'd given them all a ride, this one 10, 11, 12-year-old kid walks up to me and he said, "You look like my granddad." I didn't know what to say. And before I could say anything, he just grabbed me and held me. And I don't mean he hugged my neck. I mean he held on to me. At that moment, what I felt was absolute, complete, unconditional love. I was his granddad. He was my grandson. Dr. Lohr told me that after my first sermon, Amy and Sean Parham came up to him and they liked the story about the dog story. You remember the one? Scratch one dog's back, all dogs wag their tails. They told that Dr. Lohr that when Ava sees them hugging and kissing her older brother Reed, that she sits there and laughs and claps her hands. For who do you know who really knows you? Knows your heart. Then there's the short story, The Gift of the Magi. You remember a loving couple who want to give each other something significant for Christmas. She has this tremendously long hair that she cuts off, sells to a wig maker to buy a gold chain for his watch. And he goes out and sells his watch so he can buy her an ivory comb for her beautiful hair. Now, the irony of those gifts and the awkwardness of that Christmas day occurs to me. He has a gold watch chain, but no watch. She has a beautiful ivory comb that won't stay in her short hair. The point is, sometimes we love so much that we give more than we can afford. It's not a matter of money. It's a matter of realizing that giving up who you are in a very real sense is counterproductive to being in a loving relationship. I'm thinking of a woman who probably didn't cut her hair since she was a child. Giving up something so precious, so much a part of her, for what? An accoutrement, a gold watch chain. And the man sells a watch, probably an heirloom, belonged to his grandfather. Giving up who you are can come back on you as resentment. We can end up resenting what we've given because what we've given is too much. We've stepped over the line, crossed the border between who we are and who the other person is. Boundaries have got to be part of a loving relationship. And even if they did know you, know your heart, is there anything they would discover in you that you could honestly take credit for? A sesshin is a very intensive part of a Zen Buddhist meditation period. I went to one 7-day sesshin in July of this year. I did all the cooking for it too. I cooked all the food and froze it. And it was my teacher's wife, Ruben Habito Sensei's wife, Marie, it was her job to reheat the food, to repair the meal. That's what my father used to say when my mother reheated leftovers. "Darling, you really know how to repair a meal." Well, during a break, she was so worried that first day that during a break, I went ahead and did everything that needed to be done to reheat the meal. And when we went back into the zendo, I slipped a note on her cushion. Later, she told me that that note should become the motto of the Sangha, the community. Without thinking, I had written, "Don't worry, it's all been taken care of. Don't worry, it's all been taken care of." Just for a moment, let us all, me and you, everybody here, release the death grip that we have on our reality. And imagine for a second, not that everything will be fine, that everything will be okay, but that everything is fine. Everything is okay. There's nothing that needs to be done, but yes, there is a but. Just for a moment, think about this. The reason it's hard to receive is that gifts are to be used. We must use what we've been given. When we are gifted, when we are talented, there remains the question, are our talents, our gifts, what matters deeply in our hearts? Are these things a part of our life, a part of what we do and who we are? And if not, then who are we? Isn't everything you have and everything you are sheer gifts from blank? This is a Unitarian church, so you can fill in the blank yourself. Doesn't really matter who or what gave them. It's not the giving that's useful. It's the gifts that work the miracles. And it goes in a circle. You feel like giving, your heart expands, and then you receive, and it expands again, and you give again, and so it goes on and on. There's a wonderful story in the book entitled Kitchen Table Wisdom by Rachel Naomi Riemann. It tells of a young man who was a football star in high school and college, and then he developed a problem with his right leg, and it had to be removed right above the knee. And it saved his life, but in another sense, it ended his life. No more girls, no more stardom. He took to what young men take to when confronted with seemingly impassable situations in life: drink, drugs, depression, and fast cars. After his second wreck in one of those fast cars, he was referred to Dr. Riemann. He was angry with everyone who was whole. He was angry with the doctors for taking his leg. He didn't want to talk about his anger, so she encouraged him to draw. She handed him a piece of paper and some crayons. So he made the outline of a vase. And then down the center of the vase, he made a crack, and he kept drawing that crack over and over and over again until he had ripped the paper. On subsequent visits to her office, he began bringing in newspaper articles about young men and women who had lost limbs, vision, and mobility in tragic accidents. His emphasis was on the fact that no doctor, no psychologist, no therapist knew what these people needed. Finally, after she collected a lot of these articles from him, she said, "Well, wouldn't you like to do something about these people?" "No," he said at the beginning of the hour, but at the end of the hour, he recanted and said, "Yes." It wasn't hard, no trouble at all, really, in the teaching hospital she worked at, to find people with injuries as life-limiting as his. So he began visiting people like himself. He would return from those visits amazed. First amazed that he'd been able to reach out, then amazed that he'd been able to do what the doctors couldn't do. Finally, it became a sort of ministry for him. And that's when he was sent to the room of a young lady, 21 years of age, who had just had a radical mastectomy. She laid in her bed, her eyes closed. There was rock and roll music softly playing in the background, and he began talking to her, but she wouldn't open her eyes. He tried every way he knew to get her to talk. Finally, he became angry at one point and said things that only someone in his condition could say to someone in hers. He'd worn shorts that day so that she could see he had a false leg. But if she didn't open her eyes, she couldn't see. So he undid the leg, and it fell to the floor. And she opened her eyes. And he started snapping his fingers to the beat of that rock and roll music and laughing and hopping around on one leg like he was dancing. And pretty soon, she burst into laughter, and she said through her laughter, "Fella, if you can dance, maybe I can learn to sing." She began visiting people with him in the hospital, and eventually they became husband and wife. You see, we can't pick out those that we love. Quite unexpectedly, they are presented to us. This is how Dr. Riemann ended that story. Suffering is intimately connected with wholeness. The power in suffering to promote integrity is not only a Christian belief. It has been a part of almost every religious tradition. Suffering shapes the life force, sometimes into anger, sometimes into blame and self-pity. Eventually, it may show us the freedom of loving and serving life. The last time Dr. Riemann saw this young man, she pulled out his file and that picture fell out. And he said, "You know what? That's not finished." She handed him the picture and he took a big yellow crayon and he began to make heavy lines of gold streaming and radiating from the blackened and torn crack in the vase. And then he added, "This is where the light comes through." There are times in life when we offer people gifts and we don't even know we're doing so. I attended the ninth grade in Japan, and years later I met a young lady who was in my class, and she had become a veterinarian, and she wanted me to know that a conversation in the ninth grade had convinced her that she should work the rest of her life with animals. I could not and I cannot remember that conversation. The Buddhists say that sometimes a word can be a bridge for people. And as most of you know, I was the preacher and minister at a small Christian church in East Texas for 20 months. Oh, we didn't have many people, about half the amount that was in right over here. And I was amazed that after the sermon, people would walk up to me and tell me what they thought I'd said. Generally, it in no way resembled anything I had said. The upshot of all this is, knowingly or unknowingly, we can become agents of change for people. We can say something that means very little to us, but those words can be the very thing that person needs to hear at that particular moment in time. I think a lot more goes on, a lot more of this goes on than we realize. I don't think it's spooky, and I don't think it's supernatural. I think it just simply points to the randomness with which the human mind works. The Rolling Stones once sang, "You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want. But if you try sometimes, you try sometimes. You just might get what you need." My apologies for sounding like Forrest Gump again, but life is a lot like sailing. My stepfather, a Marine major, taught me how to sail. Now, if you want to get from point A to point B in a sailboat, you just can't jump in the boat and push go and go to point B. There's a little thing called the wind, which blows where it chooses. You can make all the plans in the world, ask all the questions you want, be seen with all the right people, be where it's happening, whatever it is that's happening, chart all the courses you want. But if you ain't got wind, you ain't got nothing. In sailing, using the wind is called tacking. You zigzag across the wind, your goal in mind, but seemingly at times you're not going toward your destination. To learn to tack in life, you have to be mindful of two things. You have to be mindful of what you've been given and what has been taken away. As the existential philosopher and novelist Albert Camus once said, but he said it in French, "That which blocks my way makes me travel along it." Who among us can command the wind? Who make happen what they want to happen, when they want it to happen? Who can change the past or shape the future? Not a one. But as humans filled with the spirit of being human, we have an affinity with the wind. Earlier I said the wind blows where it chooses. And now I'm going to give you the rest of that quote from the Gospel of John. The wind blows where it chooses, and you hear the sound of it, but you do not know where it comes from or where it goes. So it is with everyone born of the Spirit. And that, my friends, is each and every one of us. For the humanists in the congregation, that spirit is akin to the soul as defined by Paul Tillich in my last sermon, remember? Spirit or soul is the principle of movement. It moves the stars, it moves animals, it moves us, it moves the world. It's as empirically real as the good earth we stand on. When thinking of curves that life can throw us, I couldn't help but think of the psychotherapist Viktor Frankl. On September the 3rd, 1997, Viktor E. Frankl, author of the landmark book Man's Search for Meaning — it had originally been entitled From Death Camp to Existentialism, but that didn't sell too good. Anyway, on September the 3rd, 1997, he died at the age of 92. Frankl survived the Holocaust, even though he was in four death camps, including Auschwitz, from 1942 to 1945. His entire family, his brothers, his sisters, his mother, his father, his aunts, his uncles, his cousins, wiped out in the camps. During and partly because of his suffering, he developed a revolutionary approach to psychotherapy known as logotherapy. At the core of this therapy is the belief that humanity's primary motivational force is the search for meaning. I'm going to read four quotes from Man's Search for Meaning. Think about the words, but also think about the fact that these words were written by a man who had suffered greatly, loss of his family, the daily threat of life, living in a place that stunk to high heaven and that must have resembled hell. What matters, therefore, is not the meaning of life in general, but rather the specific meaning of a person's life at a given moment. It did not really matter what we expected from life, but rather what life expected from us. We needed to stop asking about the meaning of life and instead to think of ourselves as those who were being questioned by life, hourly, daily, Our answer must consist not in talk and meditation, but in right action, right conduct. The meaning of our existence is not invented by us. It is rather detected. And the last, and I saved it for last because I think it's the essence. Everything can be taken from a person, but the last of the human freedoms, and what is that freedom? To choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own life. Speaking of choosing one's own life and one's own attitude, I'm reminded of the Jewish story. My father-in-law told me this, of the man who, this happened a long time ago, Eastern Europe, he did everything wrong. He was doing the wrong thing at the wrong time all the time. He would have been called the village idiot, but that's not politically correct nowadays. One morning he got up and fixed himself breakfast. He just buttered some bread, and on the way to the table he dropped it, and it landed butter side up. Well, he ran to the rabbi and he said, told him about this auspicious occasion, the bread landing butter side up. And the rabbi said, I'll consult the elders, go back to your house. The next day, the man got up, fixed himself breakfast again. And again, on the way to the table, he dropped it and it landed butter side up. He ran to the rabbi and said, look, you've got to get the elders now and meet. This is so important. So the elders met in the synagogue with the rabbi. And after about an hour, the rabbi came out and he said, we've decided you buttered your bread on the wrong side. My friends, there will always be those in authority who are willing to tell you that you are buttering your bread on the wrong side. Don't you believe them? For the Jews of the 30s and 40s, the overall dominant cultural position in Germany was that they were vermin and should be exterminated. Survivors like Frankel help us remember that no matter what the dominant culture says, no matter what the dominant culture believes, no matter what the dominant culture does, there is a haven known as the right to choose one's own attitude towards one's own life. As Gandhi said, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. More recently in our own culture, on December the 1st, 1955, Sister Rosa Parks decided that she knew which side of the bread was buttered on when she didn't get up and give her seat on a bus to a white man. As the Neville Brothers sang in their 1989 release, Yellow Moon, thank you, Miss Rosa, you were the spark that started our freedom movement. Thank you, Sister Rosa Parks. Sister Rosa died this past Monday. She was also 92. You and I have the spirit to move with just about anything that moves. We can go with the flow. We can go against the flow. We can learn to tack in this life. There are no roadblocks, just scenic detours. And who knows? A detour may take you where you were headed all along. We're being taught lessons every day, and that which once frightened us may, by and by, when we've gotten past the shock of our initial experience, lift our hearts to a place of new meaning.